Wearing a mask and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT on the air, live for CKUT. Oh, what?
Good evening and welcome to the January 22nd edition of DromaText. Tonight on the show we're going to play a couple of old television specials found on YouTube, Poetry USA. They're 2 half-hour episodes. First one covers the work of Philip Whalen and Gary Snyder, and the second, Denise Levertov and Charles Olson. It includes readings by all 4 poets. So here they are.
USA Poetry. This program is devoted to the work of Philip Whalen and Gary Snyder. The only printed biography of the poet Philip Whalen is very brief. It reads, born Portland, Oregon, October 1923, U.S. Army Air Force, 1943 to 1946, Reed College, Bachelor of Arts degree in Literature and Languages, 1951. Although Philip Whalen is frequently identified as a poet of the Beat Generation, the character of his life and work has little resemblance to the sensational publicity that has become associated with the term Beat.
Oh, I work all the time, actually. That's one of the curses of poetry, is that you don't get a day off. I'm working every day and most of the night, because a lot of the times I'm dreaming things and I will write them down later and put them into a story or into a poem. So it's a 24-hour day job and it goes on all the time.
Frequently, Philip Whalen's books contain pages from his notebooks and examples of his excellent calligraphy.
Your attention gets scattered with boiling tea water or with worrying about the war or about 100 million other things, and you wander away from what I think of as being the basic necessities or basic realities of existence. I walk usually every day and I go out through Golden Gate Park or go out downtown to the library or walk down to North Beach and see people there, or walk up here on the hill to the top of Mount Olympus, or to look at the weather and look at the light. I love the light here in San Francisco, the way it flattens out across everything and lights it up from different angles, and the way the whole landscape changes when the clouds go over it. You don't start being a poet, you get born that way. That's all. Poeta nascitur non fit, or whatever Mr. Horace said about that. I suppose that one of my first poetical experiences was that of having my appendix burst and having an emergency operation and being in the hospital the first time, and having an ether vision of great enlightenment, and also a physical experience of light as itself, and a feeling of the total, an odd feeling of the total meaningfulness and rightness of existence, and so that was one thing that happened. Another thing that happened was some sort of small Satori vision or whatnot one day when I was so 4 years old. I came into the room where my toys were usually kept, and there was sunlight coming through French windows onto a hardwood floor. And there was something about the relationship between those windows and the light and the floor and the closet where the toys were that all made a funny kind of poetical breakthrough to my head that I always remembered. And it also connects, of course, with that ether vision that came a little later. And that and a lot of other experiences without any other, without ether or anything else, just of walking around and looking at things and listening to people and watching the world, and have all gone into a habit of hearing and seeing that is the basis of poetry, or is actually poetry, because after all, poetry is a description of this high kind of consciousness and of understanding, I think. With any luck at all, when the person reads the stuff, he'll get some feeling about that existence or that understanding or that excitement. I often use a reading to test out poetry that I've been working on recently, quite often I'll read brand new things at a reading that haven't been published or sometimes aren't even typewritten yet. I'm still reading from a handwritten manuscript to see if the poem is really there or not, and to see also whether it gets across to an audience or to a prospective reader or whatnot. Also, I can test out on my own ear that way, and ultimately, all my poems are an ear thing. So I hear them internally and compose them. They compose themselves, and I compose on them, sort of like music is done, I suppose.
The California Palace of the Legion of Honor is a San Francisco museum that has many of the works of the French sculptor Rodin. Since this location is more or less on the Whalen walking route, it's not surprising that he has written a poem titled Homage to Rodin. The poem was published in 1962 in the magazine Foot.
Thinker, in the classic Paris style, shows up in old New Yorker cartoons, appears in some houses as plaster bookends. A great animal, the biggest goon Rodin could find for a model, or magnified him. I think most Frenchmen are small by nature. Animal for sure. We customarily think man, human, soul, confronted with this kind of creature. I, we, and so forth. Concomitant fantasies of art, politics, religion. Rodin says animal, who sits down, which is one difference, apparently doing nothing. To calculate, cerebrate. And that's of the first significance. Meek, thinking, and got hands to build you what he means, or throttle you if you get in the way. Either action without too many qualms. Hands, feet, arms, shoulders, legs, Rodin says. We're in the habit of thinking man, subject for the psychiatrist. Old stuff, we say. Rodin, Rilke's employer. Oh yes, Rodin, but after all, Archipienko, Arp, Brancusi, Calder, Henry Moore, sculpture for our time. That is, they appear in Harpo's Bazoo, modern, chic, seriously discussed in Vogue. Epstein and Lipschitz are out, the heroic, Tejas as Rodin. Nobody knows what it is, hulking, beefy, nude. We all the time wearing clothes and arguing quest for values. Forget what we are, overbusy with who. The only time we sit still is on the toilet, and then most of us read. The only quiet and private room where we have bodies we wish away. Rodin, body, with head containing brains, hands to grab with, build, possibly, the physiologist says, hands helped enlarge the brain, feet to come and go, buttocks for sitting down to figure it out. How isn't it wonderful? How is it base materialism? Why do we insist there is nothing we can do? 2, Land's End, the shades. I won't go to the park today, informal prospects, groups of noble trees, play land at the beach instead. You never saw a merry-go-round go so fast. 2 fat old men watch it from a bench. 1 sings words to the tune everyone else forgot.
No amount of sympathetic observation will do any good. Why not get older, fatter, poorer, fall apart in creaky amusement park and let the world holler? Softly shining pewter ocean, or let it quit, who cares? The road to the Palace of the Legion of Honor still broke. About 1,000 feet of it don't exist. I walk along the edge above the foghorns and dim fish boat passing the rocks, anise and mustard, pine trees and fog. Formal building, pillared propylon and stoa, honneur et patrie, apse and dome and Greek pantheon life size. A few golfers look at them. Just below the apse, Fort Miley steel fence, empty concrete bunkers, coast artillery, no defense, no more meaning than the gods, a wonder of expenditure. The whole outfit, stone, marble, pipe organ, and all built by a single family, given away, more or less. Nobody home but Cezanne. Amusement high-class park to remember dead soldiers and the late Monsieur Rodin. No amount of reflection on the noble prospectless dead, no amount of indignation does any good. They are blanked, puzzled-looking, the shades. They stand, head bent down, three arms pointing toward the ground that covers them, young burly ghosts wondering. We like to kill each other. We like to grab with both hands, with our teeth and toenails. Unless you've got sharp teeth and toenails, you end up watching the merry-go-round. Not even a dime for popcorn, nor anything to chew it with. Then there's a quote. Everything was all right until that man came along, and we decided to be kind to everybody. That's the trouble with us. Now we're too kind. We ought to kick him all right in the ass and stay home and mind our own business, which is being mean as hell. Fat kid wants expensive camera daddy to put two bits into Cliff House binoculars. His father screams in reply, furious, insane. What do you want to look at them rocks? What do you want to see in this fog? Come on, the fat kid hollers. Give me 25 cents. Put 25 cents in. Give me 25 cents. I want to see them rocks out there. Come on. Give me 25 cents. And his father screaming back at him like he might tear the kid limb from limb, actually looking in another direction, quite relaxed. There's all this loose hatefulness rolling around. We spend all our time hating the world, the Russians, the government, the job, the noise, the cops, our friends, our families, and ourselves for not changing, rearranging, not being able to find what to change or what we'd use to do the job. A woman plays in the surf, tight jersey pants, a kind of sweater top with sleeves, fully dressed, but the water doesn't hurt her clothes. Oblivious to her girlfriend hollering at her from the sand at the foot of the stairs, she plunges, laughing, through a wave. Part 3, Water Lilies and Iris. Fog washing past Mount Sutro, Parnassus, the medical school, a mirage, that city in the sea. Leaves over the sky where these water lilies grow up through my mind. Flowers in the water, not to be reached or touched. Pool of enchantment, pink granite curbing says before the young museum. Short reeds in Shrubby Island, Hiawatha boy blows flute at cougar pair, one crouching, one sitting, their ears laid back, enchanted. Black water, thick mud at the bottom, lily bulbs, head in the dark, pattern of stars inside, buried lights. First a few lobed circles on the water, then leaf mountain with pink pecker buds, open flowers, unmistakably women, that never fade nor wither. Impregnated, they withdraw beneath the waves. No mystery. Genes in every cell manifest themselves. Bulb of the earth showing itself here as lilies. The summer flowers, underwater globes of winter, all the same. Since you'd gone, I hadn't thought of other women, only you alive inside my head, the rest of me ghosted up and down the town alone, thinking how we were together. You bright as I am dark, hidden. Inside the museum, I see Rodin's iris, torso of a woman, some sort of dancer's exercise, left foot down, toes grasping the ground, right hand clutches right instep, right elbow dislocating, reveals the flower entirely open, purely itself. Unconscious, all concentrations on the pose, she has no head. Its light blasts all my foggy notions, snaps me back into the general flesh, an order greater than my personal gloom, frees me. I let you go at last, I can reach and touch again, summer flesh and winter bronze, opposite seasons of a single earth.
In 1959, Philip Whalen was asked to write a statement about his own work. The result was a press release titled Since You Ask Me.
Since You Ask Me. This poetry is a picture or graph of a mind moving, which is a world body being here and now, which is history and you. Or think about the Wilson Cloud Chamber, not ideogram, not poetic beauty, bald-faced didacticism moving, as Dr. Johnson commands all poetry should, from the particular to the general. Not that Johnson was right, nor that I'm trying to inherit his mantle as a literary dictator, but only the title, doctor, that is, teacher, who is constantly studying. I do not put down the academy, but have assumed its function in my own person, and in the strictest sense of the word, academy, a walking grove of trees. But I cannot and will not solve any problems or answer any questions. My life has been spent in the midst of heroic landscapes which never overwhelmed me, and yet I live in a single room in the city, the room, a lens focusing on a sheet of paper or the inside of your head. How do you like your world?
Gary Snyder is another poet identified with the Pacific Northwest, San Francisco, and Reed College. Snyder now lives in Kyoto, Japan, where he is a student of Zen. But for part of 1965, he was a lecturer in the English department at the University of California at Berkeley. When asked to ad lib a biography, he gave his usual direct answer.
Well, I'd have to tell the truth. I was born in San Francisco, and at a very early age, I was moved to Seattle, where I grew up on a small farm just north of Seattle. Later, about 12, we moved to Portland, Oregon. I went to college in Portland, Oregon, graduated from Reed College, spent a little time at Indiana University, and then came back to the Bay Area. I went here to Berkeley in the Oriental Languages Department for about 3 years, and then for the last 8 years, I've almost constantly been living in Japan.
Gary Snyder's poetry readings are exceptionally popular. All of the emphasis is upon the poetry itself, and the readings are as plain and simple as his Japanese student's uniform.
As a poet, I hold the most archaic values on earth. They go back to the Paleolithic. And all of science and civilization, so-called progress, never has and never will improve on them. These values are the fertility of the soil, the magic of animals, the power of vision and solitude, the terrifying initiation and rebirth, the love and ecstasy of the dance, the common work of the tribe. My poems are about work, love, death, and the quest for wisdom. What we have is the ground beneath our feet, our minds and bodies, the man and woman who bore us, the man or woman we live with, the children we have made, and the friends we know. First, I'd like to read a couple of poems from my first book, Rip Rap. Rip Rap, here in the West, means a cobble of stone laid on steep rock to make a trail for horses in the mountains. The two poems I'm going to read from this book were written after I had been working for the Park Service on a trail crew in the high country of Yosemite National Park. Hay for the horses. He had driven half the night from far down San Joaquin through Mariposa up the dangerous mountain roads, and pulled in at 8 a.m. with his big truck load of hay behind the barn. With winch and ropes and hooks, we stacked the bales up clean to splintery redwood rafters high in the dark, flecks of alfalfa whirling through shingle cracks of light, itch of hay dust in the sweaty shirt and shoes. At lunchtime, under black oak, out in the hot corral, the old mare nosing lunch pails, grasshoppers crackling in the weeds. I'm 68, he said. I first bucked hay when I was 17. I thought that day I started, I sure would hate to do this all my life. And damn it, that's just what I've gone and done. Above Pate Valley. Pate Valley is in the northern section of the Yosemite National Park. We finished clearing the last section of trail by noon, high on a ridgeside, 2,000 feet above the creek, reached the pass, went on beyond the white pine groves, granite shoulders, to a small green meadow watered by the snow, edged with aspen, sun straight high and blazing, but the air was cool. Ate a cold fried trout in the trembling shadows. I spied a glitter and found a flake, black volcanic glass, obsidian by a flower. Hands and knees pushing the bare grass, thousands of arrowhead leavings over 100 yards. Not one good head, just razor flakes. On a hill snowed all but summer, a land of fat summer deer, they came to camp on their own trails. I followed my own trail here, picked up the cold drill, pick, single jack, and sack of dynamite. 10,000 years. This section is called the Market. Especially it refers to the old Crystal Palace Market in San Francisco, the beautiful public market in Saigon, the public market in Kathmandu, Nepal, and the market along the Das Asvamed Ghat in Benares. The Market. Heart of the city, downtown, the countryside. John Muir, up before dawn, packing pears in the best boxes, beat out the others to market, to Crystal Palace, on the morning milk run train. Me, milk bottles by bike, Guernsey milk, 6% butterfat, raw and left to rise natural, 10 cents a quart. Slipped on the frost turning into a driveway and broke all 9 bottles. That was when we had cows. A feathery hemlock out back by manure pile where one cow once lay with milk fever, transfusions and worries until the vet come. We do this still dark in the morning. Part one. To town on high, thin wheeled carts, squat on the box top stall, papayas, banana, sliced fish, grated ginger, fruit for fish, meat for flowers, French bread for ladle, steamer, tea giant, rough glaze earthware for brass shrine bowls. Push through fish, bound pullets lay on their sides, wet slab, watch us with glimmering eye, slosh, water. A carrot, a lettuce, a ball of cooked noodle, beggars hang by the flower stall. Give them all some. Strong women, dirt from the hills in her nails. Valley thatch houses, palm groves for hedges, rice field and thrasher to white rice, dongs and piastres to market the changes. How much is our change? Part two. 75 feet hold rows equals 1 hour explaining power steering equals 2 big crayfish equals all the buttermilk you can drink equals 12 pounds cauliflower equals 5 cartons Greek olives equals hitchhiking from Ogden, Utah to Burns, Oregon equals aspirin, iodine, and bandages equals a lay in Naples equals beef equals lamb ribs, equals patna, long grain rice, 8 pounds, equals 2 kilograms soybeans, equals a boxwood geisha comb, equals the whole family at the movies, equals whipping dirty clothes on rocks 3 days, some Indian river, equals piecing off beggars 2 weeks, equals bootlace and shoelace, equals one gross inflatable plastic pillows, equals a large box of pity for show cram, barley threshing, mangoes, apples, custard apples, raspberries, equals picking 3 flat strawberries, equals a Christmas tree, equals a taxi ride, carrots, daikon, eggplant, green peppers, oregano, white, goat, cheese, equals fresh-eyed bonito, live clams, a swordfish, a salmon, a handful of silvery smelt in the pocket, whiskey in cars, out late after dates, old folks eating cake in secret, breast milk enough if the belly be fed, and wash down, hose off aisles, reach under fruit stands, green gross rack, meat scum on chopped blocks, bloody butcher concrete floor, old knives sharpened down to scalpels, brown wrap paper rolls, stiff push broom back, wet spilled food. When the market is closed, the cleanup comes, equals a billy goat pushing through people, stinking and grabbing a cabbage, arrogant, tough, he took it, they let him, Kathmandu, the market. I gave a man 70 pice in return for a clay pot of curds. Was it worth it? How can I tell? 3. They eat feces in the dark on stone floors. One-legged animals, hopping cows, limping dogs, blind cats, crunching garbage in the market, broken fingers, cabbage, head on the ground. Who has young face, open pit eyes, between the bullock carts and people, head pivot with the footsteps passing by, dark scrotum spilled on the street, penis laid by his thigh, torso turns with the sun. I came to buy a few bananas by the Ganges while waiting for my wife. Now the rest of the poems I'm going to read are all from an uncollected, unpublished collection of poems which will be called The Backcountry and which will be dedicated to Kenneth Rexroth. These are all shorter poems of the last 6 years. This is called A Cabin in Marin County. Sun breaks over the eucalyptus, grove below the wet pasture, water's about hot. I sit in the open window and roll a smoke. Distant dogs bark, a pair of cawing crows, the twang of a pygmy nut hatch high in a pine. From behind the cypress windrow, the mare moves up, grazing. A soft, continuous roar comes out of the far valley of the 6-lane highway. Thousands and thousands of cars driving men to work. We won't be white men 1,000 years from now. We won't be white men 50 years from now, quite. And the whole society is going someplace else. I feel that this is one of the most exciting works of poetry right now, is to capture and make contact with those areas of the unconscious that belong to
the whole American continent, the non-white world, the world of mythology and intuitive insight that belongs with primitive cultures, and ultimately getting back in touch not only with ourselves but with the natural world, with nature, which we've been out of contact with so long that we've almost destroyed the planet.
Gary Snyder's poem, The Market, is from a work in progress titled Mountains and Rivers Without End.
This program is devoted to Denisov and Charles Olson.
I always took it for granted that I was a poet. I mean, I knew from an age before I had a concept. I accepted the fact that I was a person who wrote poems. And I thought at various stages that I was also going to be a ballet dancer, and then that I was also going to be a painter, because I painted all through my teens. But I always felt, without question, that I was going to write poems, and I had begun at an early age, and I never stopped writing poems. I didn't write very frequently, I guess, in certain years, but this was something that was always going on. There did come a point when that became the central thing, though.
On Greenwich Street, not in the village, but on the Lower West Side in New York City, the poet Denise Levertov lives with her husband, the novelist Mitchell Goodman. The Goodmans live in the top floor, and there's no elevator. The sign on the door is a housing authority sign meaning artist in residence. Although she is without question an American poet, Denise Levertov was actually born in England in October 1923.
My mother is Welsh, and my father was a Russian Jew who settled in England and became an Anglican parson. So I grew up in England, but I didn't go to school, and therefore I don't think I was ever very English. I mean, I felt Welsh, and I felt Russian-Jewish, you know. I loved England, I loved the English country and the English language, but I didn't really share a background with other English poets that I knew. So that when I came to America, I was sort of fit material for the melting pot, you know, especially as I was quite young, but not really that young in years. I was about, 24, I guess, when I came to England, but I was very young for my age,
to America.
I mean, Mitch and I, my husband and I, are the same age, and we were 23, I guess, when we met, and we, in Michael Rumeker's phrase, referring to himself, we feel that we were 23 going on 16. When we met, you know. So I was actually, I think, very, very immature when I when I came here, and therefore able to become an American poet, and perhaps someone who comes here when they're older and more developed as a person never gets to be. English writers, I mean, who settle in America, you know.
We met in a youth hostel in Geneva, Switzerland, but very much by accident. There was a mixed company of many kinds of Europeans moving around the continent after the war, and we had been separately hitchhiking around Europe in 1947 with friends.
In opposite directions. Sort of.
Going in opposite directions, yeah. And we met there. After we met, I left and got on the road. After I got on the road, I thought twice about it and decided to come back.
Yeah, we're married 18 years, actually, which is rather startling. Living in New York has been, in some ways, a somewhat arbitrary thing for us, because we don't live here all year round. We have an old farmhouse in Maine, and we go up there in the summer. I feel a great need to be in the country and to see trees and walk on earth and grass instead of on concrete, but I do feel very much at home in New York. I'm sort of a New Yorker. I know my way around in the subway, the streets, and so forth.
I do more work in Maine than I do here.
With me, it probably varies, but I think the most work I ever did in any year was the year that I had a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the most work that I did in that year was done during the part of it that was spent in Maine.
It was interesting, you know, as a woman poet, that Denise was in that Guggenheim year, she put a lot of that money into machinery, like a washing machine and a dryer, and it really made a lot of difference, you know.
If you look in the kitchen, in fact, you'll see that the washing machine says the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Washing Machine, the dishwasher says the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Dishwasher. And this is not as flippant as it sounds. I'm really very, very grateful to have had these things, and they made a great difference to my life. There's a dryer in the bedroom. I copied out by hand several times, usually, before I get to the point of typing it. And then in typing it, I make various corrections. And then when I think the poem is done, I copy it into this notebook because I always lose typescripts, and this is something, you know, that I don't lose, touch wood. I don't tend to lose these comic books.
Denise Levertov's most recent books are The Jacob's Ladder, published by New Directions in 1962, and O Taste and See, New Directions 1964. The following poems are from the latter book.
The Ache of Marriage. The Ache of Marriage. Thigh and tongue, beloved, are heavy with it. It throbs in the teeth. We look for communion and are turned away, beloved, each and each. It is Leviathan and we in its belly, looking for joy, some joy not to be known outside it. Two by two in the arc of the ache of it. And then you also wanted me to read, I think, the one called Losing Track. Losing Track. Long after you have swung back away from me, I think you are still with me. You come in close to the shore on the tide, and nudge me awake the way a boat adrift nudges the pier. Am I a pier, half in, half out of the water? And in the pleasure of that communion, I lose track. The moon I watch goes down, the tide swings you away before I know I'm alone again long since. Mud sucking at grey and black timbers of me, a light growth of green dreams drying. Thank you. I don't have very much current work. I sort of got hung up this winter on wanting to, feeling I had to write a poem about the war and not being able to do it, and being unable to do anything else as a result, until a certain point when I did do a poem that was totally unrelated to anything like that, and writing that one seemed to make it possible to write the one I've been hung up on all the time.
This must be it.
This poem doesn't have a title as yet. I have to find a title for it. And this was not a dream. It was a sort of waking vision. Two angels among the throng of angels paused in the upward abyss, facing angel to angel. Blue and green glowed the wing feathers of one angel, from red to gold the sheen of the others. These two, so far as angels may dispute,
were poised on the brink of dispute, brink of fall from angelic stature. For these tall ones, angels whose wingspan encompasses entire earthly villages, whose heads, if their feet touched earth, would top pines or redwoods, live by their vision's harmony, which sees at one glance the dark and light of the moon. These two hovered dazed before one another, for one saw the sea-feathered, peacock-breakered crests of the other angel's magnificence, different from his own, and the other's eyes flickered with vision of flame petalings, cream-gold grain-feather glitterings, the wings of his fellow, and both in immortal danger of dwindling, of dropping into the remote forms of a lesser being. But as these angels, the only halted ones among the many who passed and repassed, trod air as swimmers tread water, each gazing on the angelic wings of the other, the intelligence proper to great angels flew into their wings, the intelligence called intellectual love, which, understanding the perfections of scarlet, leapt up among blues and greens strong-shafted, and among amber down illumined the sapphire bloom, so that each angel was iridescent with the strange, newly seen hues he watched, and their discovering pause, and the speech their silent interchange of perfection was, never became a shrinking to opposites, and they remained free in the heavenly chasm, remained angels, but dreaming angels, each imbued with the mysteries of the other. The other poem, the one that I've been hung up on, which I wrote after that. It's called Life at War. The disasters numb within us, caught in the chest, rolling in the brain like pebbles. The feeling resembles lumps of raw dough weighing down a child's stomach on baking day. Or Rilke said it, my heart, could I say of it, it overflows with bitterness. But no, as though its contents were simply balled into formless lumps, thus do I carry it about. The same war continues. We have breathed the grits of it in all our lives. Our lungs are pocked with it. The mucous membrane of our dreams coated with it. The imagination filmed over with the gray filth of it. The knowledge that humankind, delicate man, whose flesh responds to a caress, whose eyes are flowers that perceive the stars, whose music excels the music of birds, whose laughter matches the laughter of dogs, whose understanding manifests designs fairer than the spider's most intricate web, still turns without surprise, with mere regret, to the scheduled breaking open of breasts whose milk runs out over the entrails of still alive babies, transformation of witnessing eyes to pulp fragments, implosion of skinned penises into carcass gullies. We are the humans, men who can make. Being so lovely, we have believed one another the mirror image of a god we felt as good, who do these acts, who convince ourselves it is necessary. These acts are done to our own flesh. Burned human flesh is smelling in Vietnam as I write. Yes, This is the knowledge that jostles for space in our bodies, along with all we go on knowing of joy, of love. Our nerve filaments twitch with its presence, day and night. Nothing we say has not the husky phlegm of it in the saying. Nothing we do has the quickness, the sureness, the deep intelligence living at peace would have. I feel that I've only just begun to have some understanding of what the angel poem is about, and not enough understanding to want to talk about it, because it was a mystery to me. I hadn't been thinking about angels. The vision of angels appeared, as far as my consciousness was concerned, out of nowhere. And it seemed at the time of writing quite unrelated to anything that I had consciously in mind. Since they were written very close to one another, and since one did seem to pave the way for the other to be written, I presume that there is actually some underlying relation between them, but I don't feel that I understand what it was. The angel poem is a mediumistic kind of poem, and the war poem is a poem that expresses what I know I think and feel.
Well, Lily, she said it was an arabesque I made off the porch the night of the St. Valentine's Day storm into the snow. Now, did she fail, of course, to make the point what a sight I was, the size I am, all over the storm, trying to be graceful, or was it? She hadn't seen me in 19 years. Like, right off the Orontes, the Jews are unique because they settled astride the East African Rift. Nobody else will grant, like he said, the volcano any one of us does sit upon in quite such a tangible fashion. The surprise when Yellowstone kicks up a fuss. When it says excessively rough moraine, I count such shapes this evening in the universe. I run back home out of the new moon. Makes fun of me in each puddle on the road. The war of Africa against Eurasia has just begun again. Gondwana.
This is Charles Olson, born December 27th, 1910. And to say that his size, energy, and imagination are prodigious is almost an understatement. In 1950, Charles Olson wrote an essay which grew out of an exchange of letters with the poet Robert Creeley. The essay was titled Projective Verse, and it set forth many of the technical and philosophical principles of what has been called the New American Poetry.
I looked around and I found there isn't any Ars Poetica in existence. Literally.
Olson's Projective Verse essay set forth the concept of open verse, or composition by field, as opposed to closed verse or composition by inherited literary forms with set line patterns and rhyme schemes. Olson even spoke of the typewriter as the modern poet's stave and bar, such as a musician uses, and by means of which the poet can indicate exactly the breath, the pauses, the suspensions, even of syllables, in the words and the lines. Form, in the new poetry, is never more than an extension of content. The poem grows from the inside out, that is to say, organically, like anything in nature.
We arrange the measurements, now we have to get to nature. That's where we are today, and science and poetry today is brilliant because it's already now becoming, returning to what again my great master and the companion of my poem, Mr. Whitehead, said. Called his cosmology the philosophy of organism.
In recent years, Charles Olson has returned to his hometown of Gloucester, Massachusetts. It is here that he is writing his Maximus poems, a major poetic undertaking comparable in scope, according to some critics, to the cantos of Ezra Pound. The first volume of the Maximus poems was published in 1960 by Jargon Corinth Books. Letter 27, Maximus to Dogtown, is a poem that Olson withheld from that first volume. As always, the setting is Gloucester. And incidentally, the word polis in the final line of the poem is the Greek word for city.
Maximus to Dogtown, letter 27, withheld. I come back to the geography of it. The land falling off to the left where my father shot his scabby golf and the rest of us played baseball into the summer darkness until no flies could be seen, and we came home to our various piazzas where the women buzzed. To the left, the land fell to the city. To the right, it fell to the sea. I was so young, my first memory is of a tent spread to feed lobsters to Rexall conventioners. And my father, a man for kicks, came out of the tent roaring with a bread knife in his teeth to take care of a druggist. They'd told him he'd made a pass at my mother. She laughing so sure, as round as her face. Heinz pink and apple under one of those frame hats women then. This is no bare incoming of novel abstract form. This is no welter or the forms of those events. This, Greeks, is the stopping of the battle. It is the imposing of all those antecedent predecessions, the precessions of me, the generation of those facts which are my words. It is coming from all that I no longer am, yet am. The slow westward motion of more than I am. There is no strict personal order for my inheritance. No Greek will be able to discriminate my body. An American is a complex of occasions, themselves a geometry of spatial nature. I have this sense that I am one with my skin. Plus this, that forever the geography leans in on me. I compel, backwards I compel Gloucester to yield, to change. Polis is this. The basic understanding is that you don't understand. That's a very, very brilliant truth. I can read you the best poem I ever wrote, The Librarian. It's all Frank Moore, describing him as my brother, the brother who got born misshapen and all this. Oh, boy. It's a hard poem to read. Because it's... I hope I can read it.
Dutch.
Called the library. The landscape. The landscape. Again, Gloucester. The shore one of me is, duplicates, and from which, from offshore, I, Maximus, am removed, observed. In this night, I moved on the territory with combinations, new mixtures of old and known personages. The leader, my father in an old guise, here selling books and manuscripts. My thought was, as I looked in the window of his shop, there should be materials here for Maximus. When, then, I saw he was the young musician, has been there, been before me, before. It turned out it wasn't a shop, it was a loft, wharf house, in which, as he walked me around a year ago, came back. I had been there before with my wife and son. I didn't remember. He presented me insinuations via himself and his girl, both of whom I had known for years, but never in Gloucester. I had moved them in to my country. His previous appearance had been in my parents' bedroom, where I found him intimate with my former wife. This boy was now the librarian of Gloucester, Massachusetts. Black space, old fish house, motions of ghosts, I dogging his steps. He, not my father, by name himself, with his face twisted at birth, possessed of knowledge, pretentious, giving me what in the instant I knew better of. But the somber place, the flooring, crude like a waltz in a barn's space. I was struck by the fact I was in Gloucester and that my daughter was there, that I would see her. She was over the cut. I hadn't even connected her with my being there, that she was here, that she was there in the promised land, the cut. But there was this business of poets, that all my Jews were in the fish house too, that the librarian had made a party. I was to read. There were many of them slumped around. It was not for me. I was outside. It was the fort. The fort was in East Gloucester, old Gorton's Wharf, where the library was. It was a region of coal houses, bins. In one, a gang was beating someone to death in a corner of the labyrinth of fences. I could see their arms and shoulders whacking down, but not the victim. I got out of there, but cops trailed me along the fort beach toward the tavern. The place is still half dark, mud, coal dust. There is no light east of the bridge. Only on the headland toward the harbor from Cressy's have I seen it once, when my daughter ran out on a spit of sand, isn't even there. Where is Bristow? When does 1A get me home? I am caught in Gloucester. What's buried behind Lufkin's diner? Who is Frank Moore? You live with your people as well as your ghosts.
The Librarian is included in the book The Distances, poems by Charles Olson, published by Grove Press.
Vulcan, like Neptune's father, Apollo's father, Vulcan. We need that like a hole in our heads. We need neither Vulcan nor Apollo. We need only heaven and earth.
You've been listening to two episodes of Poetry USA, probably recorded in the early 1960s. The first covered the work of Philip Whalen and Gary Snyder, and the second, Denise Levertov.
Are you ready?
Are you ready for the sound experience of a lifetime? Are you ready for crystal clarity in sonic bliss? Are you ready for CKUT? We're ready for you. 90.3 on your FM dial.
C'est maintenant le temps de prendre votre rendez-vous pour votre dose de rappel contre la COVID-19. Allez sur québec.ca/vaccin-COVID pour suivre la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prendre votre rendez-vous en ligne. Pour bien vous protéger contre la COVID-19 et ses variants, vous devez recevoir la dose de rappel et continuer de respecter la distanciation, de porter le masque et de laver vos mains. La dose de rappel, un moyen de nous protéger plus longtemps. Un message du gouvernement du Québec. Prenez le temps de prendre votre rendez-vous pour votre dose de rappel contre la COVID-19. Allez sur québec.ca/vaccin-COVID pour suivre la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prendre votre rendez-vous en ligne. Pour bien vous protéger contre la COVID-19 et ses variants, vous devez recevoir la dose de rappel et continuer de respecter la distanciation, de porter le masque et de laver vos mains. La dose de rappel, un moyen de nous protéger plus longtemps. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Venez prêter main forte à la campagne de vaccination contre la COVID-19. Nous recherchons des personnes pour administrer les vaccins, des préposés à l'entretien, des agents administratifs, des préposés à l'accueil et des agents de sécurité. Vous êtes étudiant, retraité, vaccinateur? Faites la différence et contribuez à améliorer la santé de la population en participant à cette opération d'envergure. Informez-vous et manifestez votre intérêt dès maintenant sur jecontribuecovid19.gouv.qc.ca. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Vous écoutez Chaud pour le Monstone sur les ondes de CKUT 90.3 FM. Il est présentement 21h et on écoute la pièce Gwendoline descendue de Bernard Gagnon.